This is the Day Zero update for May 15th, 2016. I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And this is going to be a bit of a different kind of show this week, because usually we do news discussion stories, but today we've got a couple of really cool guests, and I'm looking forward to introducing them right now, so let's get on with it. We've got, from the My Life in Gaming channel, we've got Corey and Tri-Ace.
Triforce.
That's all right. Yeah. Well, let's try. Yeah. I'm not even going to try to. Triforce, Tri-Ace. Why do I keep. I don't know why I get that mixed
just
up.
Say it's cause you're, just say it's because you're Canadian, Phil.
Yeah, okay. I'll just blame Canada. That's the easiest thing
exactly.
to do.
Exactly.
So, try harder.
So anyways, Lee was largely responsible for getting these guys on, so I'll just throw over to Lee for now, and let's just get us going.
All right, cool. Yeah, absolutely. So, like we've been talking over the last couple of weeks, so Corey and Triforce, we greatly appreciate you. I mean, Triforce is Mark, right? Is that your name?
Yeah.
I just want to make sure.
Mark,
do you have a preference?
Whatever, okay. Whatever you want to call me.
Well, most people call me Delicious, but I'm not going to ask y'all to do that during the podcast. Okay. It might be a little awkward since we just met. But no, first of all, thank you guys for coming. We really appreciate it. I stumbled onto your videos, because I fell down the RGB rabbit hole. So, what I want to do is you're just gonna start from the beginning. So, first of all, who are you guys and where are you from?
I'm Corey. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and we started the channel. It's like 2.5 years ago now, right?
Yeah, it's almost. It was
3 years in October.
It was October 2013, so it's over 2.5 years.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. What about you, Mark?
I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and yeah. What else must we say about
long walks on the beach?
Yeah, I mean, both of us our professional backgrounds are in video,
right.
I'm one of the co-founders of a game collection tracking site called the Backloggery, and it's more focused on tracking, your actual completion status of a game. Have you finished this game? Have you beaten this game? Have you completed 100%? Corey, I've been doing, I've been part of the community and streams there since like 2007 is when we launched the site. And Corey has been a longtime member of the site, and, we've got sort of a tight-knit core community there. And me and Corey just kind of hit it off, I think, because, we sort of shared similar professions and sort of had, I think, a lot of similar tastes and perspectives in games. And, we played some online games like Resident Evil 5 and stuff. And, right. and just hit it off. And we started talking about how to hook up retro consoles and stuff, and we started coming across these websites that were talking about these video scalers and stuff, and we're looking at these pictures and thinking, this can't be real. You can't do that. I know what you can get out of these consoles. I've been using them my whole life, and you just can't do better than I know what the best is. I thought I did. And so we were looking at the Framemeister and all this kind of stuff about RGB video. And I'm like, what? There's the Super Nintendo outputs a signal better than S video. I had no idea. And so we just talked endlessly about that stuff. And since we're both into video stuff, we were always talking about video equipment we were buying and capture equipment. And eventually we had set up we had both pretty much developed this exact same setup, collaborating with each other, where we're using a Framemeister and we're using these video splitters and we're using these, HD capture cards. And we're like, wow, we can capture any of our consoles in 1080p. The retro consoles look better than anything anyone else is putting on YouTube, at least it's not captured with an emulator. Like, we're capturing real hardware and, you know, practically emulation quality. We're like, we should make a YouTube channel. Right. So
we kind of started with something that didn't have anything to do with that. Like, we started like our first set of videos were based on these old, like, how to win at Nintendo game videotapes.
Oh yeah, I used to remember those.
I remember those.
So we recreated those with new games, but we also, like, you know, laid everything off to VHS, then recorded it back. Right. Nice. So they looked like the exact, like, what they looked like.
Yeah, I saw those. Those are hilarious.
We got, like, professional newscaster voice over for them, like, literally a guy that has no idea what he's reading. So, like, the confusion you hear in his voice is authentic.
Yeah. I noticed that. I was wondering where you would, like, I was like, this guy doesn't sound like he's actually ever played any of these games, and he's just reading them. Like, the Shovel Knight one was great. He was like, there's the Black Knight. You could hear it in his voice where he's like, who?
Yeah, so I mean, we had a lot of fun making those, and
we kind of joke about that we had all this equipment to record the best possible video signal, and then we just, like, crapped it up.
Yeah,
that was VHS.
It's so funny because we still get comments on those videos that's like, what kind of filter did you use? And it's like, dude, VHS players didn't, like, suddenly disappear. They aren't, like, you know? Yeah. So what we did with those, I mean, we captured digitally. We edited digitally. But we did use a real genuine 90s graphics generator for the titles. and we just export it to VHS and re-record it in as VHS. So it is authentic VHS quality. And I think, like, that's just one of those concepts that, like, Corey just pitched that, like, several months before we were even really thinking about really doing a channel. And he said, he was showing me these videos on YouTube of, you know, he had these tapes as a kid, and he was showing them to me, and it was like, wouldn't it be awesome if you did this with modern games? And I was just like, yes. And it's just awesome. It's just one of those concepts that I think just immediately resonates, because it's such a simple concept, but it, you know, it's
if
it's
you amazing. Had those tapes growing up, like, you'd know.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Even though I didn't have them, I was just like, I was just enjoying watching them on YouTube so much. So we started doing that. And I think it was a good concept for us to hit on early on, because it was something that it didn't really matter who we were. It didn't matter that people didn't know who we were or care about what our opinions on something was. It was just a concept that anyone could enjoy. And we got a lot of we got a lot of attention, like, right out of the gate. And that, I think, kind of served as a means of starting to build a small audience. And then we did the stuff that we were really kind of originally wanting to do, which was sort of just talk about, you know, some of our
games we like.
Favorite games. Yeah. So, you know, we feel like we start off just talking about that stuff, like, who would have cared, who are these guys, but we pulled people in with something else, and then we started talking about games and other topics. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because actually pretty much everybody on this podcast, a lot of us go back at least 15 years. Mm-hmm. We had a website, gameaddicts.net, and what was funny about it is we all came together because of the GameSpot forums, like, back in, I think it was like 98 or 99, when it was like, oh, the internet is cool. Like, there's no jerks on the internet. Everybody's, like, honest. People want to have discussions about things. Like, so, which is obvious. And now it's just like cats and assholes. But, you know, so you, like, we all, that's how a lot of us met. And then we started doing website stuff together. And then, you know, just throughout the years, we've all kept up. And then, of course, that's led to Smash Pat and Phil and Pat doing all that stuff. And so it is kind of interesting to see how just something, you know, a passion that you have can end up sort of leading to something else. And like, for us, particularly me and Pat, the trapdoor for us was arcade games, like Street Fighter. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, like, when you have that sort of shared experience, even if you didn't have that experience with that person, it sort of builds a bridge, like to what you were talking about with the videos. Anybody, even if you haven't seen those videos, anybody that was around in the 80s and the 90s remembers what all that stuff was like. The strategy guides, where you'd see the stuff that was like unofficial, like the things Nintendo doesn't want you to know. It's like tabloids for video games. Yeah. You know, so you tap into that sort of shared experience, and then you know you can kind of pull people in. And it's interesting. I didn't know you had started Backloggery. I look at that site and I look at my backlog and I get very upset.
that's kind of the idea. People air their stuff and they're like, I had no idea.
I got a lot of work to do.
It's a shame, because you know the funny thing about the channel is that my career as a backlogger has taken a serious hit due to the YouTube show, because at one point, you know, when before we even started the actual Backloggery site, we were kind of, you know, me and my friend and another friend that started the site, we were sort of just really doing it amongst ourselves. You know, we were old forum buddies, just like you guys were saying you were. And we sort of made a blog where we were just like, we just like listed our games on and we updated it manually by hand. And we were eventually like, maybe other people would enjoy this. And when we started that whole process, probably in about 2000, early 2006, I had well over 100 unfinished games, and I sort of weeded through my collection. I'm like, okay, do I not really want to play through this game? Like, if this game doesn't really mean anything to me, if it's not really grabbing me, like, why do I even own it if I'm not going to play all the way through? So I weeded out a lot of games, got rid of a lot of games, and just, you know, made a big effort to get through them all. And then I finally, and like, Corey remembers this because it was
it was 2008. It was a week before I got married. I remember watching your live stream and finished the last game.
Yeah, my last unfinished game in my backlog was Super Ghouls and Ghosts, and I had zero unfinished games. There was not a single game on my shelf that I had not finished.
Oh, you poor child.
And you know, and for the next several years, I managed to, you know, stay under like 10 unfinished games, and I was really proud of that. And then over the years, it started creeping up a little more. And then me and Corey start a YouTube channel. All of my effort is starting to go into that, and now I'm battling to stay under 100 unfinished games because now I'm buying all these other games. It's like, ooh, this is interesting. This would make an interesting video topic. And so I buy this game long before I'm going to play it. I don't have the time to play through it. And so, yeah, it's crazy how all that balances out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that it's balanced. I think that's like the struggle. We've talked about that on this podcast before. It's like most interesting part now of being grown and everybody having jobs and everything. It's like, oh, I actually have some money now, but I don't have any time. It's just like, oh, this game looks interesting. I should pick it up. And then like you're looking at it on a shelf like 3 years later and going, huh?
Yeah.
I probably should play that one of these days. So
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, from our talks earlier, Corey, I know you and I had spoken about this. So you guys, both of your backgrounds are in video, right?
Right.
Right.
I went to school for it in Buffalo, New York, and I lived in New York City for 11 years, where I worked as an assistant editor freelance, and I was a staff editor at a post-production house until 2014. Before moving to Cincinnati, Ohio. And now I work freelance out of my home doing video editing.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say, what's interesting to me is one of the things that struck me when I first came across your videos after I kind of fell down the RGB rabbit hole was your YouTube videos are very different than a lot of other channels I've seen. Most of the channels are always like, you know, hey guys, it's your boy Herpaderp69, and here's a bunch of random cuts that I put together to make a video. Yeah. But yours are definitely a lot like that. I mean,
it was very important. It was one of the first things that we talked about when we started the channel. We said, you know, there's not a lot of stuff out there that's like really like well edited. You know, I mean, of course there's like stuff out there that is, but we kind of said, you know, if we just keep that quality, eventually it's going to catch on.
Right. And I think,
It really, it has. I mean, it's been a slow right. climb. I kind of feel like we've done it. You know, we didn't have a video that just like blew us up like right away. Mm-hmm. We've had a very slow climb.
YouTube favors personality over production. And we're behind the scenes guys, and you know, every once in a while we get some mean comments like, these people should know better than to get in front of a camera. And it's like, whatever, dude, we know we're not presenters. Like, we're a lot better than we were when we started out, but we're just trying to be ourselves. We're just trying to be simple and honest about it. And
when we originally like started the channel, we had no intention of ever being on camera.
Right.
And I think we were at a panel for RetroWare TV at MAGFest. And we said, you know, we could do this. We could be on camera.
Right.
And we started like a little bit, like a couple of weeks later.
Right. Even though, like, you know, we don't think we have some sort of, you know, over the top personality that's going to win over the majority of YouTube. But at the end of the day, like, people do respond.
They connect better with what you're saying.
They connect. They see you. Yeah. They respond better when they can associate, you know, a person with the video. And, you know, it doesn't do it for everyone. The way we do it doesn't do it for everyone. And that's okay, because we feel like we're doing it right for the people who do appreciate what we do, and we're doing the best we can. But you know, at the end of the day, it's about editing for us and being thorough and researched with our topics.
Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I really appreciate about like going through your videos for the RGB Masterclass and looked at your series spotlights and all of that stuff, is you take a lot of time to make sure you've got stuff right. And even though you guys claim that you're not experts, you know, the fact of the matter is you contact those experts.
Oh, yes. Right. Especially for the RGB stuff. Yeah. We have a huge amount of people that fact check us and, you know, suggest things to us. Yeah. We would not be able to, that series would not be what it is without the help of, you know, the countless people that help us out. And you know, it was very important to us that we really respect the community. You know, we wanted to get it right for them.
Yeah That's why when, you know, if I recommend one of your videos to a friend, I know there's not going to really be any factual errors in there, because you take the time to go through and make sure that you got your stuff right. So
we've had
that.
A couple of stumbles here and there.
Every once in a while, something slips through. We add an annotation after the fact, but you know, we try to keep it honest. I mean, it I always say I'm amazed by just how many nice people are in what I would term the RGB community. I would expect it to be. Would have expected to be kind of an elitist thing, you know, getting the best picture out of your retro consoles. True. But people have just been, we have met some of the the smartest people in that community are some of the nicest people that I've ever met online. I mean, they are incredibly smart and incredibly nice and incredibly
willing to help
and understand and appreciate what we're trying to do in making it accessible to everyone. Because at the end of the day, I mean, yes, we're video people, but we don't necessarily understand the electronics of how it works. And when we were first trying to get into this, looking on these websites, one of the reasons we had a hard time believing like this stuff was possible was because so much of the conversation was all, you know, it was electrical engineers talking to electrical engineers. And we're like, I don't understand what's going on here. What makes this do this and what makes this do that? And eventually, you know, we kept saying we were breaking through to a new level. And we're like, the light bulb goes off. And so the way we always put it is, we're trying to make the video series that we wish existed when we were trying to get into this, the resource. And there are lots of great resources out there, but we're trying to add to that and do it in just a way that's like, look, you may not know how to mod your own system. You may not know how to build your own cables. You may not understand the electrical pulses that are going down the cables, but anyone can appreciate good video quality. And
right.
And we want to say, look, here are the things that you can do. Maybe you have to hire some people's services. Maybe you have to buy some equipment that other people know how to make on their own. But you can do this. This is accessible to anyone. And right. And people in the community are very willing and excited to have us distill that in that way.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because the reason that I stumbled onto your videos, and then, of course, I started talking to everybody here about them, was because, like we had discussed previously, my background is in the fighting game community. I help run Final Round here in Atlanta. We've been doing it. We just had our 19th year. And one of the things that's really important to fighting game enthusiasts is number one, obviously how the games play, but how you're actually able to perceive that information, because frame data matters a tremendous amount in fighting games. You know, if you're missing frames, you're missing the ability to hit someone, you're missing the ability to combo, stuff like that. And we ran into a problem relatively early down here, because there were still arcades in California, there were still arcades in New York, but there was nothing down here. And so, you know, we were having people that were hauling in CRTs to our tournaments, and then they couldn't do that anymore because we would depend on the community to bring stuff. And it's really difficult to ask somebody, like, we have a bunch of guys that come down from North Carolina, actually. And it's really difficult for them to be like, hey, man, listen, that 36-inch TV, can you strap that to your trunk and drive, you know, 400 miles down here? I know it's raining. Just put a tarp on it. We need the TV, you know. So, you know, so we would run into that. And so, you know, they gradually switched over to, you know, LCDs and LEDs. And that's when I first encountered the FrameMeister and seeing some of the stuff that people could do to it. And what was interesting to me was when I sort of, you know, started to fall down that rabbit hole, I did notice what you were mentioning. It does seem like a lot of people were nicer in a way that I was not expecting, because I'm really into video, I'm really into audio, and it's very easy to run into elitists on those sides of things. For some right. reason, that seems to be like, oh, well, you know, you don't have a Kuro, you know, a Panasonic Kuro plasma TV from 2008. What are you, a noob? And it's like, well, hold up, man. I'm just getting into this. And really, that's something that we see in the fighting game community too. It's very easy to chase off new people. So mm-hmm. that was what was interesting when I started kind of digging, you know, digging into this. And then I found your channel. And by the way, you know, and I know everybody on the podcast feels that way. The RGB Masterclass videos are really amazing. I would not have yes. been able to hook up any of the stuff that I have, or really find any of the resources that I have, if it hadn't been for that setup. And one of the things that the most helpful thing for me out of everything that you guys did was how you showed everything was hooked up. Because I swear to God, I chased that for like 2.5 weeks, where I was just like, I just need to know what you plug this one thing into. And like, right. And everybody would like just go way over. So you got to run this. You got to do that. I got that. Can you just send me a picture of what you have hooked? That's what I need. I need a picture. And so then I found your videos, and then I found the hookup one. And that was that was my light bulb going off. Like, I understood a lot of the technical stuff and everything else like that. I'm like, okay, I need this cable. Got that. Cool. I know what a SCART cable is. I got all that. But I need to. I got to make sure I'm plugging this portion up right. And so that was the light bulb for me. Mm. Out of curiosity, how many views does that video have compared to some of your other stuff?
The first RGB video has just passed 100,000, actually.
Nice.
That, you know, when we first conceptualized the series, it was not going to be a series. It was just one video.
Right, because it was like, this was ultimately what had led to the channel, and it was just, we were still just like so in awe of this RGB stuff and that it works. And we just thought, if we went our whole lives knowing that this wasn't possible, like, think about how many retro gamers are out there who also don't know about it. And so we were just making this as a video, like, we love talking about this, like, you know, this is something we're really excited about. I think we thought it would do well, but then when it really started picking up, we're like, wow, you know, let's think about this. Like, there are so many different topics and angles that you could look at, and specific systems, and every system is different. And so we just were like, yeah, we can make this into a series. And we've got years and years and years and years worth of topics. And I think what else is also interesting is this is not a dead field. It's, you would think that, okay, retro games are what they are. We've left them behind, and there is this set amount of knowledge to know about them. No, people are developing new mods, new technology, new ways to play these systems. You're still ultimately using the original processing of the system, but you're able to represent it in a new way through maybe RGB that wasn't originally part of the system, or HDMI that is, you know, made to easily connect to your modern TV. And I think that's another thing for us that's big for us, is it's not about picking one best way to do it and say, okay, do this. We go from the bottom. We say, you know, here are all the things this system can do. Here are all the things people have done with it. You know, here's the pros and cons of each, but we're not going to tell you what to do. What works best for your setup, what works best for your preferences might be totally different. And we just want you to know what is possible so you can make the decision yourself. We just got a comment on our PlayStation episode that was like, why didn't you just tell us what it was up front without 20 minutes of stuff I didn't care about? And I'm like, especially with the PlayStation, there's no clear-cut answer. Just like we tell you what you can do. We tell you what the result looks like on all of these different ways to play PS1 games. You decide what works best for your setup, your budget, whether you're playing on a CRT or an HDTV, if you have an external scaler. I don't know. I'm not telling people to go spend $300 on, you know, all these pieces of equipment. Do you already got PS3? Does the fact that PS3 is using emulation and not hardware, does that bother you? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. You decide for yourself. There's not necessarily a clear answer. We're just trying to tell you this is what's possible.
It was very important for us to make people feel that the way that they're doing, they were not telling them that the way that they're doing things is wrong. Mm-hmm. The thing, like the way that they're happy with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, yeah, that's a good point. That was something I did pick up too with the videos, because it is one thing whenever you're into, you know, whether it's video, audio, video games, like with Pat and I, fighting games, stuff like that. It's very easy, I think, to sort of get sucked into, this is the only way to do this, or this is the only way that you guys should.
And
this
is the way you should be doing it.
Right. Yeah. And that was something I did notice about your stuff too, because it is funny that you mentioned that, because one of the guys that I ran into at Final Round, I was really taken aback, because there were a couple of people that had Framemeisters for some of their setups. Like, they had Saturns hooked up and things like that. And one guy was there and had a Nintendo hooked up, but he had it hooked up through composite cables. And he was like, and I was talking to him, and I was like, well, why don't you just get a modded Nintendo? Why don't you do this through RGB? It'll look a lot better. He goes, because they designed the game around the way that this was supposed to look. And so this is the way that I think that I should play it. I should play it through composite. I don't need anything sharper. I got the Framemeister. This is how I'm going to play it, because this is how the creators created their art. They did all that other stuff based around what CRT televisions could do at the time. And I thought that was really interesting, because like for me, I want it to be as sharp as possible. Like I want my eyes to bleed because it is so, it looks so good, you know, and this guy's like, no.
Yourself on the pixels.
Exactly. Right. Whereas this guy's like, no, I like the little halos. Mm-hmm. I like the little bit of juddering that's there. Like this is all of this is what this was to me when I was a kid.
Yeah. Right. So. Well, it's that was something we didn't necessarily expect to run into when we made that first episode. Cause again, like Corey says, it wasn't intended to be a series. And in my mind, I was just thinking, well, you know, I had been so used to, I mean, I grew up with pretty crappy TVs, and over the years, I've just been so used to hooking up my retro consoles to HDTVs, and I didn't think a lot about it. I didn't think that much about the advantages of CRTs, because my CRTs didn't look very good as a kid. And so it was, I too, we're so used to seeing retro games represented with pixels online, where, you know, people use sprites as their avatars, and we've got sprite sheets, and we're used to seeing these characters represented with pixels and not scan lines and composite color separation and that kind of stuff. We're used to seeing that. And so in my mind, I'm thinking the ideal look for retro games is pixels. And yes, you get that out of emulators, but I like to play my games on the real system. And so I accepted that it was a little blurry and wasn't necessarily emulator quality. But then when I saw I could get emulator quality, I'm like, wow. But it was kind of a revelation to me at the time to discover that a lot of people are like, no, retro games should not look sharp. You're destroying the intended look. And I'm thinking, well, I get what you're saying, and I think it's great. Like, and sometimes I'll play on a old CRT with RF or composite. I'm not that picky, but I do. And in my main setup, I like to have the high quality sharp RGB because that's how I want to look at it. And we get so many comments that are like, you know, well, you just play on a CRT, and you know what? We sometimes do play on it. Corey now plays mostly on a CRT and uses the FrameMeister primarily as a recording device. Right. And we have a whole episode dedicated to CRTs and the advantages of playing on CRTs. But at the end of the day, don't tell people you should just play on a CRT because guess what? Most people don't want to play on a CRT, and that shouldn't, right. You know, that shouldn't prevent them from enjoying retro games or enjoying them on original hardware. Let's look at the options. Okay, if you want to play on a CRT, great. I enjoy playing on a CRT too. But the fact of the matter is, most people who want to play retro games are probably not going to want to deal with a CRT. Let's look right. at the options. Let's look at all of the possibilities, and. At the end of the day, I don't like it when people say that CRTs are the only true way to appreciate retro games, or you have to have all this nasty composite quality from the Genesis, or else you're ruining what they were intending to do with the dithered right. effect. you know, if that's your perspective, that's great. I'm glad that you enjoy looking at it that way, and I don't necessarily think it's all that offensive, but don't say that that's the only way to do it, because at the end of the day, yes, the artist may have known what kind of hardware they were working on and what it would probably look like on the TVs at the time. But if you asked those artists today, like, is there only one true way? Do I have to use composite cables and play on a crappy TV? They would just be happy you were still enjoying their work. Right. 15, 20 years later, they don't care what you're looking at it on.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things that's so interesting about this topic. Like, one of the things that we talk a lot on our show about, because we're all old, is so much of this stuff meant so much to us when we were kids. And like for me, one of the things that is interesting seeing where the game industry is going is that I sort of feel like the game industry as a whole is in that weird bump that the movie industry went in before VHS showed up. Because if you look at the history of film and everything else like that, these guys were creating their product and it was supposed to be a product. There were some people that didn't care about if it was archived or anything else like that. And then VHS came around and the movie studios were like, wait a minute, we can sell this stuff back to these people. Like, oh, we got to go find all these film prints. We got to do this. We got to do that. Like, now there's this technology where people can enjoy this stuff and we can sell it to them. And I don't feel like – I think in a way video games are sort of at that point where you're seeing retro collections and things like that come up. But it's very difficult for me at least to – and Pat and I have talked about this a lot online and offline. It's difficult to feel like what you're getting is not compromised in some way, whether it's through a horrible set of filters that makes the pixel artwork looks like somebody slapped paint across it, or whether you're dealing with lag or anything else like that. And I think for a lot of people in you know, now in 2016, having a CRT is difficult. Mm-hmm. Because number one, you can't find them new. They're heavy as hell. Like, it's funny, after I saw your videos, I actually got on Craigslist, because I have my dad's old 32-inch TV that I got when he died like 15 years ago. And I was like, well, I wouldn't mind. One of the things I'm trying to do with my son is build an arcade cabinet. I needed a CRT for it. And so I just got on Craigslist and I found like a 36-inch Wega TV for like $20. The guy was like, look, if you just come pick it up, you can have it.
Away from me.
I won't. Mm-hmm. You're not going to charge us. I got my friend Colin to come over, and we're about midway through moving this thing, and I was like, I forgot that these things were like 350 pounds, and it's just like, oh my God, and like, so that's the sort of barrier that people are running into, but at the same time, they also want to be able to play this stuff, and I never thought I would hook up my old retro consoles again, because when I did hook them up to my HDTV, they just looked terrible, and really what prompted me to kind of get into this is the stuff at Final Round, and the fact I have a 10-year-old, and I would rather play Mario with him, like Super Mario World, because he's always asking me questions like, Dad, what do you think of this game? And I'm like, and again, I guess I'm just getting old, I'm like, this new stuff sucks. I like some of it, but I totally would like just go back and play Super Mario World until like I drop dead. And then playing that on like the Wii U and then not having that original controller was just very bizarre. And then, you know, you play it on like the Wii or the Wii U, and it's there's just something about it that's missing. So like, was that something that was a driving force? Like, it sounds like it definitely was for you, Mark, to be able to play on that original hardware, because I've done emulators and it never feels right.
I mean, to be honest, I'm not necessarily that picky about emulators. I actually have a Retron 5, which I sometimes use just out of convenience. Like, for example, on the Backloggery streams, sometimes me and Drumble, the co-founder, he has a Retron. It's kind of his most convenient way to play retro games right now. And if we're, you know, our streams are 4 hours, and sometimes we like to, you know, we've been sort of collecting a lot of the same NES games or Super Nintendo games or whatever, and we like to play them on our stream at the same time, and that way we can, like, so if we get to like a trouble spot, we can sort of like, you know, give each other sort of tips of how we got past it, and it's a lot of fun to do it that way. But sometimes the game might be longer than 4 hours, and I can, you know, do it. I can turn off my system and come back to it the next day. And, you know, so sometimes I do that for convenience. You know, I have noticed that with emulation, there is lag that I didn't necessarily realize was there before. But I like having the real cartridges. I like putting them in the real system. I like having all my systems hooked up. I don't like storing them in a closet, because I don't like the idea that just because it's old doesn't mean that it's not just as important as any other system.
Yes.
You have to say something to that.
I mean, generally, like, I don't. There was a point where I was very, like, I guess, in the emulation, in that I really kind of went all in with, like, the virtual console. Like, official
games.
What's that?
You bought, like, hundreds of games.
Yeah, I have a lot of virtual console games. And, you know, I still had all my consoles from when I was a kid. You know, like, I still have my original Sega Master System, my original Genesis Sega CD. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, when at the time I was living in New York City in a small apartment, so that's what made the most sense. And
so half your game systems took up half your apartment.
Well, no, they're all at my mom's house.
Yeah, because everybody knows you can't get a big apartment in New York.
Yeah.
You can have one PlayStation in here, and then you don't have room for a bed.
Right. So I kind of went all in with the virtual console. The thing with emulation for me is that I've always kind of felt like when you have everything accessible at one time like that, you never really stop and appreciate games in the way that you would if you had, like, you know, spent money on it.
Yeah.
Instead, it's more like, oh, I have a whole list of, 400 games here. I'm just going to play this. Oh, I'm bored after 5 minutes. I'll just play something else.
Right.
It becomes really, really just disposable, I guess.
Right. When I have paid money for a game, I'm like, I might get past a hump that if I just had a list of every game ever made, I'd be like, I'm done with this. But I think that commitment to get past those hard places, those spots that you're like, I don't know, is this game doing it for me? And then you sort of sort things out and it clicks for you. You wouldn't have those moments if you didn't commit to the game. You know, I definitely don't blame, you know, that's the mentality that got the Backloggery started. Was
there,
I want to
no
see
commitment like a financial commitment.
I want to see this through to the end, and that that ultimately is what makes me enjoy the game, is I got to see this through to the end. No matter how hard it gets, no matter how much it takes, I want to see this through to the end. And if I decide I don't want to see it through to the end, then it's like, do I really need to own this? Maybe not.
Yeah. Right. Well, no, and there is definitely something to be said about that. The ability to have everything at your fingertips, I absolutely agree. I think it does take away some of that value. Like when I was I never sell anything as far as games go. Like, I don't really do the trade-in stuff, because we're talking about financial stuff. I'm like, man, I paid $60 for this or whatever. Like, you're not about to give me three quarters and a pack of M&Ms and when I trade this in. Like, this is not what I'm going to do. And, like, I grew up poor. And so, like, I remember one year we got a Super Nintendo after we had sold a bunch of stuff. And my mom asked me, she said, what do you want for Christmas? And I was like, I want Chrono Trigger. And she was like, Lee, that game's like $80. I'm like, Mom, I know. I don't want anything else. I don't want anything for my birthday. Like, this is what I want. And she came through that year. It was the only thing I got. And she got me like one or two other things. But it was the big thing that I got. And I knew how much she struggled just to be able to provide that. Because, you know, this was back – Chrono Trigger came out in 96. Mm-hmm. So $80 then compared to now is very different. It's a whole lot more money. And so that sort of at that time really kind of – put into my mind like what the value of this stuff was. So I never really sold any of my Super Nintendo games. And so when I was going back and looking at doing this stuff with the RGB and stuff that I wanted to play with my kid, I can't believe how expensive some of that stuff is now. Mm-hmm. For used, like, it's more than it was when out. And there is something about having that physicality to it. Whereas, like, I mean, I had emulators on my PSP. I've had emulators, obviously, on my computer as long as they've been around. And there is something about actually having the original in your hand and going, okay, well, this was something someone spent money on, rather than a ROM dump that you had to sit through like five ads to get.
Right.
Yeah. There's also like just that physicality of it as you're talking, Lee. You're making a deliberate decision when you pick up that cartridge and you put it in the slot. You're mm-hmm. getting into that headspace. Right. It's a lot like, you know, it's a lot like recently I've been getting into vinyl. It's like I decide, okay, I want to put this record on. I'm going to listen to that entire record.
I've kind of been getting into vinyl myself a bit more. Like my mom sold her house last summer, and she had like all of her old vinyl from when she was like a teenager and gave me all the stuff. So I've been really kind of getting into it. And, you know, especially since, you know, you kind of realize that in the digital age of MP3 is like that the art of listening to an entire album is like gone.
Yeah. Music is more like background noise now than an actual experience that you're paying attention to.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at that too. It's funny mentioning vinyl. My father was a radio DJ, mm-hmm. and so when he passed away, I probably got 2,000 records in my storage closet here, and I've been slowly like going through them. And it is like even just looking at it, you know, to do the comparison with the games. Like when you're looking at this, you have the vinyl, you have it out, you see the design on the record and everything. It's the equivalent of, oh, this is me looking at the instruction book on the way home, you know, mm-hmm. before I could put it into the game console. And it's funny, a lot of the vinyl stuff, I think, kind of mirrors essentially kind of what you guys are doing. Cause Phil has talked, you know, a lot of times before we get the podcast started, just about how much he's, oh man, you're not gonna believe how expensive this was. Oh, I could get a good turntable for this price, you know? But it is, it demands a certain level, I think, of enthusiasm and dedication that you obviously wouldn't get whether you downloaded the music or you emulated the game. So I think that's definitely definitely it's a good fun, but it is. It's fun.
Well, it's funny because last night we got a comment on our newest RGB videos that says, you guys are somewhat the vinyl enthusiast type of person within retro gaming. I said, if that is a good thing... If that is a good thing, you be the judge.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Like, I'm going to put this out there, and hopefully maybe one of you won't get offended, but the other one will. But it is true. I think anytime that you take – I think when you're looking at this stuff, particularly from like, you know, Mark, what you had mentioned a few minutes ago is you don't think probably the people that created this game care how we play them, just that they're being played. I get that feeling – looking at anything that we're talking about, like music-wise, like, you know, back then people were making albums. They weren't making singles that they could sell on iTunes. So it's a different creative process. And I think that sort of exists now compared, like, with the AAA gaming space compared to the way that things used to be done, you know, 20 years ago. They'd create a game that lasts two and a half hours. And it'd be hard as hell because, you know, somebody spent that money on it. They might not get another game for four or five months. Whereas now, you know, we'll have all these AAA blockbusters that are sort of stuffed to the gills with things that keep you busy but don't actually keep you engaged. So I do think that there's some of that there as well. But I think one of the most interesting things for me, and one of the reasons why your videos were so cool when I found them is, and you guys mentioned Vinyl for this too. My son is very into games because I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of opened me up to, like, I can teach him all of this stuff that's important to me. I can teach him how to be a man. I can teach him how to cook. I can teach him how to take care of a house. I can teach him how – well, his mom's going to teach him how to cook. I'm not that good. But I can teach him, you know, what it means to be a good person and this stuff. And then what's been interesting to me is looking back at my father's records is sort of seeing that stuff as a window to who he is. And I think my son is getting that same experience now because we'll sit down and we'll play stuff and he's just like, this is really neat. Cause all he's really into is like Minecraft and like Mario Kart and stuff like that. And Corey, I know you have kids. So I'm sure you see that as well. If they game at all, like what they do.
Well, they're not really. I mean, my daughter is going to be 4 next week. So she's in, my son is 15 months. So they're still so not.
So you haven't put a controller in his hand. You should do that. Get him started now. You might be able to make some money.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
So did you let your 4-year-old play anything at all?
I mean, she's messed around before, but she doesn't really get that, you know, you can press the directions on the D-pad to move forward. She's more just like hitting the buttons and nothing's really happening. But I mean, you know, I think once she starts preschool and talking to other kids about stuff, I think that's going to.
Oh, man, it's crazy. All my son ever does is come home and talk about Minecraft. Just like, but you know, we went out to lunch today. He was like, "Dad, let's talk about Herobrine." I'm like, I don't know who that is.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so weird because, you know, my cousin has a, gosh, how old's he going to be? I guess he's 15 now, and it's so, like, you know, he thinks of me is like, you know, I'm the cool cousin who I'm, you know, this older guy, but I like video games and stuff. And it's just like, but I have a hard time relating. I feel, you know, it's like, yes, we are both into the broader video game thing, but we're, it makes you feel old because, you know, I'm not surrounded by kids that often, but on the rare occasion I am, it's like, wow, I really am old. These kids like have a totally different perspective and totally different tastes. And, you know, and he gets so excited to play these free browser games with me, you know, when he visits my parents and I might go there, you know, for the day or something when he's there. And so I'm just like, oh my gosh, like I can't enjoy this stuff. And I wish, I just don't know how to reconcile that. It's just, but I see,
so you want to hit him with the sit down, kid. This is not a real video game.
I don't really have the right to say that. Like, I mean, there's something that they see in this stuff that I don't. But, you know, then again, at the same time, this is why, in my opinion, parents shouldn't like threaten to take away video game systems, because they're going to find crappy games to play on the internet. Whereas this is the same kid who bought Fire Emblem and Dragon Quest for his 3DS without me being the one to advise him that those are very good games. I'm like, you know what? I slapped him on the back and I said, I'm proud of you. You made some good choices there.
That's like, when you know they're going to be all right.
Yeah. but then, you know, you don't do your homework. You get your 3DS taken away for months on end. What do? You find crappy games to play online. You know, so.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's funny with that stuff, too, because one of the things that happens is I'll go to the store with my kid and they'd be like, Dad, like, can we buy this? And I'm like, no, son, that game is garbage. He's like, well, how do you know? I'm like, because, well, first of all, it's licensed crap. Like, there's no way this is actually a decent game. Like, I just start breaking it out on him. Like, I've seen this happen before. And he just looks at me like, well, can't we just try it? I'm like, not for $40. We can't. And so, you know, we go through that too. Like, it's funny seeing what he gets into, because the other day, this was a couple of weeks ago. Oh, God, no, it was probably a couple of months. God, I am old. It was probably a couple of months ago. He tried out Monster Hunter on the 3DS. And I'm like, wow, that's actually kind of hardcore, son. Like, yeah. I'm a little surprised. I don't even play Monster Hunter. And then we moved into a new house in February, and he was so good. I was like, okay, you were awesome. You didn't complain the whole time. Like, I'll go buy you a game. What do you want me to buy you? And he was like, I want a Monster Hunter for the 3DS. So I said, okay. And he's like, still playing. He's probably playing it right now while we're recording. And I'm like, even that's a little too hardcore for me. Like, I did the Monster Hunter back when it was on PSP, and you had to do like the claw with your hands and all that. Like, that was enough. And so, but he's, you know, he's been playing that. And it is that kind of thing where it's like, he also likes those browser games, and drives me nuts. I'm like, that stuff is terrible, son. And he's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, okay. I guess you're right.
Like, I don't argue that. A friend of mine said that he, I can't remember if it was an article or a podcast or something, but he heard something about the results of some survey. And of course, I have no idea, you know, how scientifically thorough it was, but where young kids were saying that, you know, these, what we think of as a throwaway mobile game, and I'm not saying all mobile is bad, but I mean, there's a certain class of mobile game that is very exploitive. But kids are saying that mobile games, not only do they prefer them and think of consoles as something that old people play, but they think that mobile games are actually better. And it's, well,
that's how you know they're not being raised right. Let's just call it what it is.
Again, you know, I don't know if it's right of me to say you're wrong, but that's incredibly, it's just like diplomatic. It just makes me think, you know, man, maybe I just don't get it anymore. But I think something we tried to do in our videos is, especially when it's a game that we played growing up or a console that we played growing up, and even if it's not, we try to look at, you know, we try to do our research and think, okay, what is the context of the environment that this game was released in, or what this system was released in? We try to talk about like what that feeling was like, even in the RGB videos. Like we sort of, if it's a console specific video, we sort of start off talking about a little bit of the history and what led up to this console and why it's designed the way it was and what the gaming environment was like at the time. Because like the N64 video, for example, I start off that episode talking about what it was like for me to experience N64 for the first time, because, you know, kids these days, they might not understand what it felt like to control Mario in this 3D environment for the first time. And that was a religious experience. I mean, it was, I had never done anything like it before, and it blew me away. And I spent so much time going over my script for that part, because I'm like, I really want to convey what it felt like to play this system at that time. And I just, so you can understand why this system holds such a special place in my heart and that kind of stuff. So I feel like a large part of what we try to do is provide context for, here is why this game or why this system or why whatever was unique or interesting, or what about it stood out at the time, and what it was like, what it felt like to play that at that time.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's something I noticed as well. And I think that's very important, because it, like with the Mario stuff, I've actually had those conversations with my kid where I'm like, you have no idea how incredible it was that this happened. Like, mm-hmm. you just, cause you know, he's all he's seen as he's grown up is fully 3D stuff. It's very easy to move around in and stuff like that. Whereas we're like, they never did this before, son. Like, this is bananas, you know? And so, yeah, the context I definitely think matters, particularly if you're introducing, like, I think we're over the hill now where a lot of this older stuff is being experienced by a lot of people, maybe for the first time. And that context is really relevant, because otherwise it's just kind of like, well, what's the big deal?
And I think you know, with the advent of streaming and stuff, like I'm not like I enjoy streaming myself. I'm not a big stream watcher, but I think a large part of the audience for that kind of stuff is, you know, younger people and you know, maybe not 10 years old young, but you know, 15, 16, 17, right. I consider that young. I mean, you think about people who are getting ready to go to college next year. I mean, they were babies when the PS2 mm-hmm. came out. It's like,
it's bananas thinking about it that way. Like, oh, have you ever thought about the fact that the Super Nintendo is old enough to drink? Like, when you contextualize it like
old
that.
Enough to drive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it's wild. I mean, when you think about the different ages people were when certain systems were out. I mean, even people who are not that much younger than me, you know, the PS2 came out. I think my senior year in high school, but then I hear people who aren't that much younger than me talking about playing the PS2 in middle school, and I'm thinking, I can't comprehend that.
Oh, I know. I'm the same way. I run into people that I play World of Warcraft, and I'll run into people online, and they're like, yeah, I started playing WoW in elementary school. And I'm like, what?
I was in college when people were getting excited about that.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like out of college and
yeah,
trying to always joke about it, because like I'm a little bit older than he is, and he's like blown away that I was 7 when the NES came out.
Like, you were playing Metal Gear Solid 1. You like took the whole
day in college, yeah,
off of school and like marathon Metal Gear Solid 1 the day it came out. And like, I just, it's so beyond me. You were what was the example we were talking about the other day that was like you were out of college when some big game came out? I can't remember what it was. Like, you were in college when Final Fantasy 7 came out. Is that right?
Oh no, that Final Fantasy 7 came out in the first week of college ever for me. And that's, you know, when you go to college, you're like, wait, I can,
so you
I can
automatically
skip,
had
I can skip classes.
Apparently.
I don't have to go to class if I want to play this new game. So that's kind of like the first time I ever didn't go to class.
I think, so video games made Corey go to college for 8 years.
Yeah.
Right. I think, you know, though, I mean, no matter how old you were when you first played a game, I think I think it's interesting to hear your perspective on that. Who was it? We were talking, was it the last podcast we were on, Corey, where someone was talking about this guy was going to make this video series or audio series or something about, he was a much older gamer, and he wanted to record his perspectives on what it was like being, you know, 20 years old when the NES came out or whatever.
That was the guy that is friends with another very good YouTube channel, Classic Gaming Quarterly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
I know that.
Yeah, it's a very, very good show. But the guy who does that show, Chris, he has a friend that he does a podcast with that's very, like, kind of, here's what it was like at this time period specifically.
Right. And this. So my perspective on the NES was, you know, well, I was 1 year old when the NES came out, but I was like four or five when I got one. So I have a certain perspective on that. Someone who was 15 has a different perspective.
So you missed all like the Mario Mania and stuff like that, because that's one of the things that I talk about with my kid is like when I was a kid, the first time I played NES, I was born in 81, and the first time I played it was 86, and I'll never forget it. I remember seeing Mario Brothers at like this childcare place my mom was taking me to because I needed somewhere to go.
I mean, Mario was huge. I mean, Mario, in my opinion, has never not been huge. But
right. Well, there was a certain thing at that time where if you, like when Mario 1 was out, like sort of seeing the mania. And what was crazy, too, is at the time I remember watching the news with my mom where the news reports were like, Nintendo's dangerous. Like, it's this thing. Oh, man, it's this thing from Japan that's taking over living rooms and it's eating your kids' souls. And it was all born out of this like xenophobia, because like Honda and Toyota had come over here and just beaten the crap out of the auto industry, and then all of a sudden here's this Japanese company that's moving into toy stores and they're taking over for your children. And that stuff perspective wise is interesting. It's the tail end of it.
Even people who are, you're 3 years older than me. I mean, so you have a different perspective. I just think it's so fascinating to think about the different perspectives and contexts that people have, just because they were a different age when something hit. And even though otherwise all the circumstances surrounding you are the same, but your age is a unique perspective into that. And I think no matter how old you are, I think it's interesting to hear what your perspective and take on that was at that time.
Right. Yeah. No. That's true. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot. Like Brandon actually talks about that a lot. You'll hear him when he's doing podcasts. He'll go, "Now look, you got to understand at the time," and then he will just talk about whatever the subject was, and to give that kind of context. And no, it's certainly relevant, and it's and like I said, I mean, I talk so much about my kid, like on this podcast, and I have obviously with you guys, but it is so interesting to have that lens now, to just kind of see what his perspective is and the way that they judge things. Like, and I think it's also interesting in the context, like, of what you guys do with the YouTube videos. Like, he wouldn't get the VHS stuff and the tip videos. He'd be like, "Why don't I just go watch a guy on YouTube beat this? Like, why is this
funny?"
Exactly. Exactly. But it's like, but for us, like people that grew up and have seen those VHS tapes, it's like, "Oh my God."
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, who was, the last time anybody saw a VHS tape?
Right now.
Oh shit. Besides you guys.
I'm in my closet.
Dude, when I was moving, I came across like a stash of anime, like Ghost in the Shell and Akira, like all on VHS.
Ninja Scroll, like, probably.
Ninja Scroll, yes. Ninja Scroll is in there. My kid was like, "What are these?" I'm like, "They're tapes." He's like, "What is a tape?" Like, "Well, son, it's this thing we used to." Yeah. So, like, he doesn't even know what it's like to rent video games.
Yeah.
No logical times.
Yeah. Right? It's funny, like, kind of is like a coming full circle with our VHS stuff. Last year, we compiled 7 episodes onto actual VHS tapes and got like these like Disney style clamshell cases, and made artwork and everything. And we made like 50 copies of them and sold them.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's some, that tactile experience, I think, is definitely missing these days. Like, I actually bought, when I was getting together some Super Nintendo games, I actually bought like those video store style cases, but then somebody would print out the artwork, and that's what I was keeping the stuff in, as opposed to just being in a box. So that's one of those things that is definitely a bygone it's a bygone of those eras. So
I think it's interesting though, because I would be curious to have I'm always having this preservation and physical versus digital conversation with video game enthusiasts primarily, but like, I would love, I mean, you know, I love movies, but I love video games a lot more than movies. And to me, like, I've gotten to this point where it's like, man, I don't want to deal with these DVDs and Blu-rays. And it's just like for me, like, I'll buy a Blu-ray once in a blue moon, but like, for the most part, I'm like, I just want to stream this. And for me, like, I can enjoy a movie, have a really good time with it, and maybe even think about it or discuss it after the fact. But it is a much more, you know, come and gone experience for me. Whereas video games are something that I want to remember and feel much more passionate about. And I would be curious, like, film buffs, like, if they really need that, like, physical copy. Because for me, I'm just thinking, I just think it's interesting for me how my perspective on film physical doesn't coincide with my perspective on.
I think, didn't we talk about this, where, you know, since, you know, like home video and stuff, these, like, the film has been ported to other mediums.
Right.
I think it was Frank Cifaldi talked about it.
Right. You're watching, you maybe emulation isn't the right word, but like you say, port, you know, you're watching a Blu-ray. You're not playing that on original hardware. You're watching a port of the film.
Right. Yeah. That's actually a really interesting way to look at it. Cause you don't have the reel to reel. You don't have a platter of film that you're watching.
An authentic experience.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead. I was going to say, I know a guy who's like really, really into movies. He's got his own home theater, like an actual theater set up in his basement. He's, you know, that hardcore. And he's all about the physical media. But the thing about him is he'll buy a movie, you know, go down to his home theater, put it into his media server, rip the entire thing as an ISO, and have it there ready on his
If I could do that, I would do the same thing, I think.
Yeah.
Have that copy of it that you could always go back to if something was to happen. Yeah. That digital copy. Yeah, that's. I think that might be something we're eventually going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
With as many digital only games, like what happens when, when.
Yeah. Well, we saw what happened.
PSN no longer exists, and it's kind of like.
I think its
current state, and are they going to keep? They're not going to keep on porting those and emulating them on future hardware. So what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think another thing that, sort of related to that is that we'll probably have to eventually accept for disc-based consoles is, they're starting to make mods now where you replace the entire disc drive with basically an SD card reader.
Yeah. There's emulators now that people are working on that actually emulate boot up processes of disk-based systems, even without the actual physical disk, and then they can load an ISO.
This is using, your Dreamcast or your GameCube or whatever to it's playing on original hardware. You're just not using an actual disc. You've replaced the disc drive with an SD card, basically, and
with an ISO on it. Yeah,
and I think those systems with those moving parts. I mean, I think, like it or not, we're probably going to eventually have to accept it if we want the original hardware experience, or heck, if we want to play the game at all. We're not going to have drives that are going to read that stuff someday, when we're 60 and 70 and 80 and hopefully 90, still wanting to play this old crap. My Dreamcast isn't going to work that long,
No.
Or at least the drive won't, but hopefully the basic processing chips will.
Yeah. It's funny. You guys mentioned Frank Cifaldi. I actually listened to him on Retronauts at one point, and he was talking about how he had gotten he had to send off his Turbo Duo because apparently the capacitors in that thing were just cheap. Nobody intended this system to be played 20, 25 years later. And so the capacitors eventually would bust and would rupture all over the board. And then, of course, it destroys your system.
Yep.
So he had talked about having to get that modded and things like that. And really, however we may feel about games, for a lot of people, for a lot of these companies that produced them, they are a product, and they were produced for hardware that does fail, that just based on the fact that there are moving parts. So that is, one of the things that we talk a lot about on this show is how that preservation of this stuff works.
Mm-hmm,
because you can look at this generation just by itself, with the exception of Microsoft. Sony hasn't really put into any effort into getting their PS3 stuff, or excuse me, their PS2 or anything else like that really up and moving in a way that we're happy with. Now, if they can resell it to you as, a new version or something else like that, they will. But, some people aren't interested in that. And I know the Mega Man collection was a big deal for me. I actually bought two copies of it on my PS4 and on my 3DS just because I felt like they were really trying to do it right. Here are these games as they existed. I remember talking to somebody I can't believe how much this game slows down. It's dropping frames. It's doing this. No, that's what the game did.
Yeah.
This is how this stuff worked, And so I hope is probably the best way to put it is that, Nintendo, I think, is the only company that has really, looked at their backlog and what they have, and I think really kind of treated it like it had some value. But even then, I have some issue with what they've done with it. But I'm hoping that companies like Sony and Microsoft and them come around, because there is all of this stuff that in you know, maybe another 10 or 15 years, we might not be able to play because that hardware is going to fail.
Well, right. I mean, like you say, they were products and they weren't, you know, the game industry is very bad at giving a crap about preserving their own history. And, that's where, you know, even though I am all about original systems, I want to play the actual cartridge, actual disc. I don't, you know, want to play a pirated copy, even though that's my personal perspective and the way that I personally play and curate my collection. I also can't help but acknowledge that piracy does serve ultimately a very important preservation function. We need pirates, because if we don't have them, then someday this stuff is, I mean, it is going to would without their efforts go away. And I am appreciative of emulation and all the effort that people put into, figuring out how this stuff worked and how to store it and how to rip it and how to distribute it, even if it may not be entirely on the up and up.
Right.
We need people who are interested and willing to do that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the other thing too that I think is really important, and I don't think really gets discussed when people talk about piracy, is that there is cultural relevance to this as well. People that played this stuff, I mean, you know, we talked, you know, a few minutes ago about context, but for a lot of people, this stuff is more than just a video game. It takes them back to a time where they felt a certain way or they believed certain mm-hmm. things. And it's in a lot of ways, it can be an interactive window to go back to where you were. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I hope the video game industry, you know, as it's matured, I hope they get to that point. That the movie industry got to. Obviously, there's a little more, you know, involved, because moving something over to VHS or then to DVD and all that, you know, that stuff is relatively standardized across the board. As, you know, getting an N64 game to play on what may come out, you know, four generations from now is a little bit different.
Right.
But I'm hoping that's something that they pick up, because I do think there is cultural relevance to it. And it is important to preserve this stuff. And to your point about pirates, you know, they are doing something important. I mean, someone might not care about what, like, say, Rondo of Blood was, but for someone else, it could be very, very important. And if they have a way to get back to that, I think that's something that's important to keep around. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, Pat's a hardcore.
I've been on the war drum about this several times.
Yeah, Pat's mm-hmm. out ordering arcade boards and everything else like that, because like this is what's important. So I hope they get to that point. It would be nice to see. And that's something that's so cool about what you guys are doing, because the videos that you've shown with the stuff that you guys have compiled really allows people to go back to that place with what they currently have. And I think that's really cool. And that's actually initially what caused me to reach out to you guys, because it was like this is really cool, because it became a way for me to share the stuff with my kid. And like, here, this is what was important to me. This lets me tell him a story about his grandmother, you know, any of these number of things, you know. So it's more than just, oh, look, this is World 4-1, you know. So it makes a difference. And that's something that is super cool about this stuff. So, well, let me ask you guys a question, because I know we're starting to run a little long. What are you guys planning on doing now? I mean, I know the channel is popular. I've seen all, you know, some of the different stuff that you guys have done. Where do you guys see yourself going in the next few years with this channel? Because I imagine it takes quite a bit of time. Your stuff is it's very nice. It's very well produced. So I can't imagine
creating. Well, we're on a roll there for a little while. We're because there's two of us, it allows us to alternate back and forth. And, you know, from last summer until the beginning of this year, we were releasing a new video every week. But because of there being two of us, we each had like 2 weeks to produce an episode.
Right.
We've kind of picked up a little bit of freelance work on our own lately. So we've resumed our old every 2 weeks schedule.
But well, how long does it take for you guys to put something together, just out of curiosity?
A lot.
Yeah.
I mean, Corey does, you know, freelance plus my life in gaming. I do, you know, I have a full-time job. I'm hoping to I've got some good things going where it's looking like it's promising that, you know, hopefully sometime this summer I could myself transition into full-time freelance work. Because, you know, my life in gaming does pull in some money, but it ain't no living. right.
In terms of the future, I think that we have.
It takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, in all honesty, like I've kind of taken it easy the past week or so. We both did because we both really wanted to play Uncharted 4.
Did you guys get a chance to do the Overwatch beta?
No.
We're not like super big first person shooters.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like first person shooters, but more for like campaign. Yeah, like I'm not like
we like co-op stuff, not competitive stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I mean, I have been taking it a little easy, and it's fun because our show has ended up being so retro focused that I kind of see modern games as like my break from it. So it is relaxing because, you know, at the end of the day, yes, it is. It is fun to put together the show. It's something I'm passionate about. It's something that I would eventually, over the years, like to be a major part of my income. And, you know, I can balance that with freelance work as I see fit. But at the end of the day, it still is work, and it does take a lot of hours. And I spend, when I'm working on an episode, I mean, I get home and I from work and I just spend the rest of my evening working on it. I mean, I would say any given episode probably takes at least, you know, not necessarily counting writing, not necessarily counting playing through a game for capture. I mean, it probably takes somewhere in the ballpark of 24 hours to shoot and edit. And over the course of many days, and in the cases of some episodes, much longer. I mean, RGB episodes are just
unbelievable. We did a one on the CRTs and PVMs that I was editing from probably like 10 in the morning until I went to bed pretty much for a week straight, and Travis was coming home and shooting additional material for me from like 5 to midnight. And, you know, we shoot everything and editing, so it's like a lot of material to get into. It can get overwhelming at times, to say the least. But
yeah,
it shows. I love the fact that I don't see your head skip around, either one of you. Like,
we're very. We'll never see jump cuts.
Where you move 2 feet to the left and you keep talking, that would just ruin everything.
Or the jump cut for us to insert a single word, you know, just cover that with B-roll. That's all you need to do.
I can't remember like a what difference video between it was,
like an editor and somebody who doesn't edit.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. And like I said earlier, you know, YouTube favors personality over production, and those people that do the jump cuts, you know, I mean, good on them that, you know, they've built the audience they have. But that's not our route, and we can't rely on that. And, we put production values first. That, if anything, if we have a hook at all, that is our hook. And not to say we're
like, it looks nice, yeah.
Not to say we're the best videographers or editors in the world, but there are comparatively few people on YouTube who do have that real world video production experience, putting that to use on their show. That was their motivation for getting into YouTube was video production and not learning video production secondarily.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think Mark of Classic Game Room and GameStack come to mind when.
Oh yeah, GameStack is a huge influence for us. It's been very nice because we've like had a chance to like really get to know, especially Joe from GameStack. He's been very, very supportive for us, and you know, like, we can talk about it because, you know, he works in video professionally as well. So we kind of can talk shop. And that's like how we became friends. We became friends working on the Video Game Years for RetroWare TV.
Oh, yeah. I love that series.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have one last question before I let you guys go. And this is by far the most serious question that I've asked on this podcast. And I need an individual answer from both of you. Which would you rather fight? 100 duck-sized horses or 1 horse-sized duck?
Really?
What?
I was probably, you know, I think a duck the size of a horse sounds terrifying.
Yeah,
it does, doesn't it?
No. See, I mean that
ducks are mean.
Yeah. Sure, but I there's also something creepy about like things that are like
really small and like,
really small, like 100 little tiny horses. Ah.
Oh my, what do I have to fight them with?
Your bare hands.
Well, bare hands are golf clubs.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, I could see a horse-sized duck like snapping you in half really easy, but
like, where's my bread?
I feel like I feel like I would stand maybe a better chance, even though it was a very large duck.
Yeah.
So you know the crazy part about this? You guys aren't going to think anything about what we talked about for the last hour and a half. We're going to finish this, and you're going to go, that guy from the Day Zero asked me about ducks and horses.
I know.
Well that is a standard Reddit question. So.
Yeah. See, the way I see it is, you know, obviously you can have a bunch of tiny little horses, but with the horse-sized duck, if you manage to kill it, you can just drag it down to the Chinese restaurant down the street.
God, Brandon.
And you get some, well, you get a pretty much lifetime supply of pecking duck. So,
I mean,
that's one way to look at it.
The horse, I don't know how like a duck sized horse is like actually going to hurt me, but the idea of it really creeps me out. Especially a swarm of them.
Yeah. But anyway, that's the important stuff, and I'm glad we were able to get it out of the way.
Yeah.
So, but thank you guys again for your time. I know you're both busy, and we really appreciate you guys coming on. We're big fans of your channel, and thank you for helping me personally navigate through some of this stuff, because it is, like I said, it is important to me. This is stuff I get to do with my kid, and just kind of like even my wife. Like, my wife plays newer games, but you know, she'll bust out with the Mario theme song. She knows all about those first 4 levels. You know, so it's that universal part. And that's something that I can have back in my house that I'm very appreciative of. And I wouldn't have, I don't think I would have gotten there if I hadn't run into the guys from Final Round and then found your channel. So
it always amazes me, like the way that people kind of stumble upon our channel, or even the people just like contact us that watch the channel. You know, I'm constantly amazed. Like a guy from Vice Media's, you know, they have a website called Motherboard, it, like, does all their tech stuff. And I got an email from them asking about something, and he's like, oh, I really like your show. You know, I don't get a lot of chance to fiddle around with this stuff anymore. So I kind of use your show as as a replacement for not being able to do that. And it's just really neat being able to see that these people that you wouldn't expect to watch the show that do.
Yeah,
it constantly blows me away.
Well, it's a cultural thing. Like, we Pat and I have talked about this for years, ever since we got to know each other, like, because we're big fighting game enthusiasts. And like with fighting games, and it's the same way with video games in general, but with fighting games, it doesn't matter if you're a Marine, it doesn't matter if you're in a wheelchair, like, you're on the same playing field as everybody else,
right?
And anybody professionally that you meet, like, I'm still taken aback by it, you know, with the people that I work with. I work with some really very professional people that are very unlike me, and then, you know, they'll find out that I'm into something, and then next thing I know, I have this person gushing to me about how they used to play Turtles in Time or something like that, and it's like, I never would have, like, what? So it's definitely universal. I could totally see that. I imagine you guys probably get comments from everyone.
Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of feedback. Our most recent video has been a very interesting experience.
Yeah, it's the newest video was what we would consider a relative throwaway in terms of the RGB series. It's about this hack that people discovered recently where you can remove the anti-aliasing from N64 games with a Game Shark. And it, like, I didn't care that much about the topic, but it was something that we needed to address.
Yeah, and we had a lot of people. It was meant to be a quick and easy video.
And so, we don't know where it got posted, but it has opened up the floodgates to a whole new audience. Frankly, typical commenter audience. But we have gotten this has been the most explosive. I mean, the past week has been the most explosive growth we have had, and it's all thanks to this really stupid video. Like, I wish it was a video
that we were not expecting.
I wish it was a video that I liked better.
Yeah, it's been interesting.
Well, I'm not surprised that it was huge though, because the anti-aliasing on the N64 could be really annoying at times. So
yeah.
Being able to get rid of that.
It's interesting, though, because a lot of people are like, this is so stupid. And it's like, look, we didn't say use it. We said, here's what it does and here's what it looks like. But a lot of people seem to be taking it as in, like,
as we're saying, like, you should do this.
You should do this. Like, so a lot, it's just a whole new audience that doesn't necessarily get how we present things and how we approach things. It's like, it's whatever, you know. It's been growth, and the people who are genuinely interested will stick around. So it's been an interesting week for our channel. We're doing well.
Well, real quick then, before we finish up, do you guys have a Patreon or anything like that?
We do.
We do have a Patreon. Yes.
Well, you should advertise that.
Plug away.
Oh, we did. I mean, it's on our thing. We did a little trailer for it. I think when we launched it like a year ago, and then we didn't say anything about it until like October, and we made a little video together, and it does pretty good. We have like 102 patrons, I think, right now.
Yeah, it's just patreon.com/mylifeingaming, one word. We really appreciate any support we can get. Especially
for the IGB series, like, we try to cover as many different things, and having that, you kind of notice when we got our Patreon that the quality and the amount of things that we were able to cover, like, immediately went up, and like the length.
A lot of it is not even necessarily equipment we're buying for ourselves, but it is stuff that we're borrowing from other people. We're paying for shipping costs, and those are avenues that we would not have gone down without the support of our patrons. And we do, like, we have a Google Doc that where we track our expenses that are directly related to the show, things that we would not have bought just for our own personal use if it weren't for a particular episode, and we track our expenses. And when we get our money from Patreon every month, we divvy it up, and it specifically goes to cover the costs of things we have bought for the show. Every bit of it is only spent on something that was used explicitly for the show. So it's not, you know,
So you guys didn't get like a speedboat. You didn't get a speedboat. And I go, yeah, but it's got a Super Nintendo on it. And we have a CRT.
Yeah.
The dashboard.
I haven't built my house on it.
Oh. I was wondering who was going to bring that one up.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, man, that was awful. Right, did you guys see the video where the guy actually apologized?
I didn't watch the video.
That was my only exposure to the whole project. I didn't know anything about. But it was the weirdest thing. It was so they had like the guy who like was.
It was the head dude.
The head dude was like had this black background, dramatic line. They had this like sad, dramatic music. He's like,
yes.
He's like.
Why?
This is something. He's like,
I just want you to know, honestly, I didn't steal.
The fact that he did that made me not trust him.
Well, like,
that video?
So what he did, he got online, right? And like, just like Mark had said, he had like this black background behind him, and he was like, "We started this project. This is what we wanted to do. And I had a business partner. And little did I know that this guy basically ran off with all this money and he built his house." And he's like, "That's not my fault. And just to prove it, I'm going to get this guy on video with me and he's going to admit it." And the next thing you know, they cut to them like in a hotel room. And they're like sitting at that little crappy round table that's in like every Motel 6 with the two chairs. And they're sitting there. And he's just like, "So..." And it's his business partner. And he's talking to me. He's like, yeah, well, when I first started prototyping this, you were the one that lent me money, right? And the guy's like, yeah. And then he's like, but then you took all of our Kickstarter money, right? And like, what'd you do with it? He's like, I built a house. And then he goes, that was wrong.
I shouldn't have done that. What got me was this sad, dramatic music that they had under the whole thing. Yeah. It was like so awkwardly produced.
And it wasn't even properly leveled.
Yeah. Oh, it was,
That's funny. That's what you noticed.
Phil. That's what I noticed.
It was like, weird.
These guys are rank amateurs.
It was weird. I don't even know what they were going for. I don't know what to make of it. Like, I don't even want to think deeply enough about it to decide, like, is this guy, like, really being honest?
Yeah, what he didn't tell you is the other guy's living in his guest house, probably.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's weird. It's weird.
Yeah, well, that's cool. That's cool that you guys actually take, you know, your list. You've taken a look at the expenses and point out what you're spending the money on as opposed to.
Yeah, it's
cocaine,
not
cocaine and hookers.
Yeah. None of that.
I don't think that wouldn't go over well with my wife.
Yeah,
I know, right? I know, definitely. Well, thank you guys again. We really appreciate it. And this is the part where Phil. This would be the part where Phil sees us out because that's what he does.
Yeah, all right. So I guess I'll get to that now. With that, I think we'll end the show for this week. I want to thank Corey and Triforce, even though I'm staring at Ace right in the face right now. So that's what confused me. For joining us on the show today, I am Filippo D'Anolfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm hungover.
I'm Lee Lamb. And I'm Lee Lamb.
And we'll see you next week.